You're listening to the Ruhi Sleep, Sleep in Society podcast, recorded in Kingston, Ontario, Canada.
I am so happy to have Dr. Jeremy Malloy on Sleep in Society podcast. Dr. Jeremy Malloy is the author of Blood, Sweat, and Fear, Violence at Workplace in North American Auto Industry. It's covering from 1960 to 1980. Welcome, Jeremy.
Hi, Ruhi. Thanks very much for having me on.
I am so happy to have you. We've been meaning to do this for over a year now, and finally here, and it's fantastic. What are you up to these days?
Okay, so I'm back in Kingston. I recently started a new role with the Sisters of Providence of St. Vincent de Paul here in Kingston on Princess Street, specifically with their Justice, Peace, and Integrity of Creation office. And I basically, in that role, advocate, educate, and organize for climate justice in our community full-time.
Amazing.
I'm also still doing some teaching, and I am designing an online course currently with the University of Victoria's Continuing Studies Department. It's called The Future of Work / The End of Work, and it is about shifts in capitalism and labor and post-work politics, AI, basic income, all those things like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's a lot. Actually, that's a lot.
It is a lot.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm also trying to write another book.
Yeah, so. Work, post-work.
Oh, the course,
Technology's impact on how it's going to change work, and then looking at basic guaranteed income, all kind of talks we've been having for the past year and a half off record.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Absolutely. So it's exciting to get to combine some of my ideas about that. In that course, I just kind of want students to be able to think about their own career, their own status as a worker, and what's how their work is going to keep changing over the past 40 years, and why it changes, and for whose benefit it changes, and what are some possibilities in imagining differences in the way that we do work, and the way that we think about work, and how we reward work, and what types of work we reward, and how. So I think it would be very relevant. And fortunately, it will be open to students who are not UVic students. So that's one of the reasons I mentioned it on your podcast today. Anybody who's interested will be able to sign up.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So I'm interested. Yeah. I might be signing up for the course.
That'd be awesome.
This is something fascinating. And so I wanted to discuss, why did you pick the era from 1960 to 1980 in terms of workplace violence? Because this is very interesting to me. Mm. And because this is post-Fordism, and I think we should define Fordism for people so they're not confusing it with our current premier at the moment.
So Fordism, I mean, there's a lot, I guess, of different ways to define it. But basically, it means the employer has a great deal of control over the production process, i.e. they have a great deal of control over who works, how long they work, what they make, how they do the job. You know, that the employer gets to control that.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other, you know, systems in which those decisions are made jointly or collectively. So the employer calls the shots. And it's about a high manufacturing output, and productivity is really central. How can we make the most of stuff for the less amount possible? And the Fordist bargain, as it's often been called, is Ford's, this involved assembly line work, turning people into machines, basically,
mm-hmm.
but also rewarding them with high wages and some benefits. So the trade-off that workers were supposed to make was you had very little autonomy on the job. Work was often undignified, unhealthy, dangerous, but in return you got a certain bargain of a certain amount of stability and an ability to participate in a consumer economy, and you were supposed to get your life satisfaction basically away from the job.
And this is after 1940s, and this is the period we're particularly referring to 1960 and 1980, but mm-hmm. I just want to go back to the post-Second World War in terms of ideas of capitalism and mass consumption and mass production that actually led to formation of consumer capitalism
mm-hmm.
That we are currently reaping the rewards of at the moment in our society. Can you go a little bit into that?
A little, sure. So to kind of expand on that, you know, when Ford really got what we call Fordism going with the assembly line and the $5 day, organized labor was not a major factor in the automotive industry, and mm-hmm. it was not nearly as much a factor in Canada or the United States as it would be in the 1930s and the 1940s. Some of the breakthroughs that unions made in terms of organizing workers and winning victories from the state and from the legal system that allowed unions to grow exponentially in the 30s and 40s, and then growth of unions slows down after that.
Mm-hmm.
But again, there's a bargain that is made theoretically through World War II. It was the Allies did not want to have strikes during World War II, so they offered to kind of extend a certain amount of stability to organized labor. Unions would be allowed to exist. They would be recognized as legitimate bargaining agents. And in return, they would maintain production during the war. There wouldn't be strikes. They would make sure that the weapons, the bombs, the guns, the helmets that the war effort needed kept getting pumped out. And so in the 50s, what that looks like after the war, people were very worried about in the post-war era about maintaining stability.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big need in a lot of different factors. Elaine Tyler May's classic book, Homeward Bound, talks about the need for stability in all kinds of aspects of domestic life because of the fear of nuclear war.
And fear of also, would you say, fear of communism as well?
Yes, absolutely.
Because I think that was actually very interesting when I was looking at your book, to reading your book, that actually kind of what I was trying to get to is that there was a shift because you wanted to bring in some form of stability in terms of economics, because you economic stability then would then you wouldn't have the fear of like equity that people were actually seeking post-World War. If we gave them economic stability, then the ideas of social equity wouldn't be progressing. Am I right? Like, this is more your...
That's absolutely correct. And there was also, you know, a big kind of rivalry both between, you know, the capitalist world and the communist world, both with each other and also appealing to states that are decolonizing through the 1950s and early 1960s. What is an attractive way of life? So there was a definite pressure exerted by the very existence of state communism for Western states to prove that their way of life, which was just coming off of the Great Depression mm-hmm. 20 years earlier, to prove that their way of life could be stable and could guarantee a strong standard of living for ordinary people.
Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't as anywhere near the ideological consensus on how that was that we came to have under neoliberalism, you know, which is a very much a one size fits all. There is no alternative. In the 1950s, there was an alternative, and people in Canada and the United States were worried that people would be attracted to that alternative. So they said, you know, they did what they could to maintain a stability. And so stability this desire for stability comes out of all of these factors. Nuclear war, communism, having come off of the twin traumas of the Great Depression and the mm-hmm. Second World War, there's a great desire to ensure some type of stability for institutions and for an economy and for capitalism. And also it was very easy for employers in the 50s and 60s in the West to guarantee this kind of thing. In North America, most European and Japanese competition, for example, have been destroyed in the war. So firms like Chrysler, in my book, mm-hmm. had a lot less competition from, say, Volkswagen and Honda than they would in the 70s and 80s. So it was kind of easier for them to make these bargains as mm-hmm. well. So you have this, what was called a Fordist economy, which is, yeah, high production. You know, a small elite controls most of the decisions about production. There's a heavy amount of collaboration between the state, between unions and corporations in directing the economy
mm-hmm.
in almost a monopolistic way. You know, there's only really three big auto manufacturers. There's only three TV stations.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually a very closed economy in a lot of ways. And, you know, through massive bargaining in these huge sectors, auto bargaining, steel bargaining, you know, patterns where all of these major companies kind of all sign on to one master agreement. You know, in the auto industry, one of the companies would generally bargain first with the United Auto Workers, and that would set the pattern for the other two. And they would choose. So they will bargain at Chrysler, and then Ford, you know, signs on to that. So.
But there was a shift in the 1960s also with the civil rights movement as well.
Yeah.
And I think that's something you also discuss in your book. Because now race and now gender is also in play in terms of workplace environment. And that's leading towards how is that leading from collective violence to individual violence? It's very intriguing.
That's a good question. And I think that's, yeah, the whole argument of my book and the whole question I'm trying to answer is how does it move from what I see at the start of this 20th century in terms of workplaces? A lot of the violence is, as you say, collective violence. Violences of large groups of workers against either the state or representatives of the company to like very much individual atomized violence. And there is certainly both collective and individual violence around race and gender in the auto industries in the 1940s. Scholars have definitely talked about that. There's a scholar named Stephen Meyer who does great work about masculinity and auto work. And he talks about sexual assault, sexual harassment being directed at female workers during World War II, and also the phenomenon, especially with black workers in the auto industry, of hate strikes, which is when black workers were hired or they were promoted into certain positions in the plant, because there are certain positions all through that are...
Sorry, this is 1940s we're
this
talking
is World
about.
War II, yeah, era,
World War
yeah.
II era, yeah.
So pre what we think of as the modern civil rights movement, when, you know, but of course black workers never stop organizing and trying to improve their position and improve their outcomes under capitalism. So like, there are some jobs in the plant that were quote-unquote black jobs, a.k.a. usually the most dirty, usually the most dangerous, as you see all through the 60s and 70s. And when blacks were successfully able to organize and have black workers moved into better jobs in the plant, often there would be a hate strike, and white coworkers would refuse to work with that person as a protest of that person shouldn't be in our department, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, collective violence does not just... orbit around class in the early 20th century. It does orbit around race. It does orbit around gender. And I guess in the 1960s, what I argue is, so you have these factories that are, I would say, stable, but unequal. So there is a stability in that society, but it's a stability based on white supremacy, based on patriarchy, based on the exclusion of different gender and sexual identities. Of you know, so there's a very, it's a very stable but a very locked in hierarchical society as we get into the 1960s.
And there's a difference too between what is happening in the auto industry in the United States and what's happening in the auto industry in Canada.
Yeah,
there's a difference. Can we talk a little bit about that? Like the difference between the violence, the nature of violence, and the differences themselves. Because I think that was very interesting to see that there was violence happening, but it was a different level.
Yeah, absolutely. So what my book tried to do, you know, you asked off the top of it, why did I choose the 60s and 70s?
Yes.
And the reason I did was because workplace violence becomes a recognized societal phenomenon in the 1980s and 1990s when you get several major incidents of workers or former workers showing up at a workplace or another public place with a gun, usually, and killing and wounding multiple people. And incidents that started to be dubbed going postal in the popular media. And this created the sense in the 80s and 90s when I was a young person that workplace violence was this new phenomenon. And it represented these new changes in the workplace. And almost all the literature when I was a PhD student started to study this topic kind of proceeded from that assumption, assuming that workplace violence was new in the 80s and 90s, and this was a new problem. We had to discover what was happening. And as someone trained as a historian, we always ask, well, you know, what are the roots of this issue? How far back does this go?
Henry Frick.
Yeah. How can we
can go back to Henry Frick on that.
Sure.
Yeah.
How can we say, you know, a problem is, what if the problem's getting better? You know, for all we know, like, what if workplaces were more violent in the 1960s and 70s than they are now?
Yeah, how do you quantify that, too? Because collective violence is so seen.
Yes.
It's so present, whereas individual violence is unseen and almost unheard unless, as you said, somebody goes postal.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And you know, that was one of the challenges in this book too, is there's so many different types of violence and they show up or don't show up in different ways. And some of them I will never know of and never see as a historian coming to this 40 years later. And there's also the time period. If someone shoots somebody, that violence occurs in an instant. But slow violence, like Rob Nixon has discussed, the violence that occurs, for example, in a worker who inhales a bit of toxic particulate every day for 20 years and it's unnoticed until
or
they
shift
have
work.
Lung cancer or shift work, right? These things are, they work on this on different time period, but that doesn't mean they're not traumatic.
Oh, they're very present.
So because, you know, there was this assumption that this started in the 1980s, I decided to go back to the 1960s and 70s, the time period directly before workplace violence became a major issue and see what it looked like then, mm-hmm. see what actually the roots were. And I decided to look at Canada and the U.S., partially because that's, you know, where my passion and my interests lie, but also because I wanted to see if there were national factors that changed the expression of workplace violence. I wanted to see if workplace violence was different in Canada and the U.S., and if it was different, why was it different? Was it national factors? Was it local? Was it regional? Racial?
What
economic?
Did you find?
So I found that I looked at Chrysler. So I looked at the same company in two cities, Windsor and Detroit, which, as we all know, are, you know, essentially one kind of mega city in some ways, but also they're completely separate and very different. Mm-hmm. But they are connected, so they're contiguous. And one union, the United Auto Workers. So doing this allowed me to kind of make like an apples to apples comparison, mm-hmm. as opposed to saying, you know, to compare a textile plant in the southern United States versus a mine in northern Ontario. And there's so many different variables there. Mm-hmm. Like, this is the same industry, the same work, the same union, the same area.
Sorry, the union's the same?
Yes.
For both Canada?
Yes.
And the United
States?
So
the United Auto Workers was an international union, and okay. Canadian Auto Workers were part of the UAW until 1986 when they split to form the Canadian Auto Workers, which then became what is now Unifor.
Okay.
But in the 60s and 70s, they were just part of the United Auto Workers, and they all went to the same convention. Whether you were the Texas group or the Ontario group, it was the same union.
Okay.
So I found that there was more violence in the American plants in the 60s and 70s. But Canadian plants were very violent. They maintained that kind of stability we talked about earlier, mm-hmm. A lot longer than the U.S. plants did. And that's because of differences in the economic situations of the two countries, the two cities, and the two plants. Basically, in Canada, we had an agreement called the Auto Pact, which meant that if U.S. automakers wanted to sell cars in Canada, mm-hmm. The government decided and made an agreement with the U.S., that they had to agree to build a certain number of those cars in Canada. So instead of Canada, I would say, having its own auto industry, building Canadian cars and selling those to Canadians, we agreed to import American cars for a promise that some of that employment would be sited in this country. And that's kind of one of the, you know, compromises or deals that Canada has made in a branch plant type of economy to try mm-hmm. and do the best it can for itself. So that meant that in the 60s and 70s, the auto industry is experiencing more competition from foreign automakers, et cetera. They start pushing their workers in Detroit harder. They start trying to make more cars for less money. And they're able to push this past the union because they're able to threaten the union effectively. The union fears that they'll lose the production. They'll lose the jobs. That the factory.
So it's being motivated by fear on union's part.
Yeah.
And it's being perpetuated by the management.
Management wants to push things harder. Mm-hmm. And they do a lot of things in the book it discusses early in the 60s to kind of dismantle the traditional controls that workers had over the production process on the
autonomy
shop floor.
Yeah, is gone. Yeah.
That gets more and more chipped away. And at that point, they've achieved total control over the factory floor, and they're able to accelerate that because there's a real fear among the Detroit unionists that they're going to lose the plant. That if they don't go along with what the company wants and just make sure that the cars keep going out, then that production will get moved to another plant.
Was that fear real, yes. retrospectively, that yes. they were going to lose jobs and because of the competition that was coming out? But it has massive repercussions overall on the industry themselves. I mean, the competition's not going to stop.
No.
But you're pushing the workers to their max
yes.
capacity. And it's not just that it's the auto industry that's being impacted. This kind of the Fordist model is also impacting other organizations as well.
Yeah.
Fordism was at one point equated with Americanism.
Absolutely. And I think I argue in the book is what you see happening in the American plants in the 60s is kind of a early canary in the coal mine example of neoliberalism and how firms are going to shift away from Fordism towards what we would call more of a networked production or neoliberal production.
So I want us to describe neoliberalism.
Okay.
Because I think it's a very... It's not a term that is basically in use in Common Consciousness. So it would be really good to just give it a little description of neoliberal model.
Yeah. Okay. So I would say that neoliberalism, and it's good because we can often use it quite freely.
Yes, just like specific. Well-being.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, all Mike's on to me about well-being. I have to write an essay on well-being very soon.
So neoliberalism to me refers to a specific arrangement of resources and power within where states and corporations collaborate to try to eliminate restrictions on capital and cut social welfare and direct that funds towards tax cuts for corporations and wealthy people in the hope that this will free businesses, if you give them as free a hand as they can in terms of they have as much resources as possible and as little obstacles as possible in terms of unions and regulations, that they will thus produce prosperity for all.
It's a deregulation. The deregulation, yes. Which they're saying in 1980s started with the Reagan, but I think it started probably with Nixon.
Going back. I think that's fair. Yeah. I definitely think it starts in Canada with it's often associated mm-hmm. with Rooney, but I would mm-hmm. argue it starts with Pierre Trudeau and the wage and price controls over the 70s. Mm-hmm. So it involves a lot of things. And we're talking, like, it's often used as a political understanding of what's happened to our political arrangements. But I guess today what I also want to talk about is what it means. It happens politically because capitalism is changing.
But neoliberal model is not a political ideology. It's an economic model. Am I right?
I would say
that?
It's both.
It's both economic because and political?
Under, a Fordist liberal consensus model that we were talking about in the 50s and 60s, right? There's a political model that says the way to ensure prosperity for our citizens is that labor and capital and the state are all interests, and they all have, they all sit down and they try to form a consensus. And if they all work together and compromise, then you can guarantee stability and prosperity going all the way around. Mm-hmm. Neoliberalism makes a political argument that the state, that only the market can create prosperity. Governments cannot ensure prosperity or stability. They cannot create jobs. When government wants to, you know, under Keynesianism, which is another name for the post-war Fordist economy, the belief is if the economy goes down, you should maybe raise some taxes on corporations and pump that money into creating jobs.
Yes.
And that will get the economy going again. They believe that this neoliberalism argues this is false, and that the state can really do nothing to create jobs except remove as many obligations and restrictions on capital as possible, because then they will be free to make the jobs.
Yeah, how's that going for our citizens and our
world?
Yeah,
it's going terribly. But what I'm saying is that that's a political argument as well as an economic one.
Because it justifies
anti-labor legislation, it justifies tax cuts, it justifies cutting the welfare state and, you know, all these
and
things.
And all the social programs, education, absolutely. Healthcare. All the things that are absolutely essential for humanity to actually not just merely survive but thrive.
Yeah, and those are seen of in neoliberalism as externalities. As you see mm-hmm. in your own field, health, wellness, those are something that we're increasingly supposed to be taking care of on
ourselves.
Our own.
It's an individual's responsibility.
So all of those things are downloaded on an individual under neoliberal capitalism.
And without any actual infrastructure or any kind of structure that supports that.
And that's a really perfect way to put it. So mm-hmm. I wanted to talk about how neoliberalism works in an economic sense, because it does respond to the shift of capital. And that's what it is. So in these auto factories, it used to be, you know, we did almost everything to make one car under one roof. All the mm-hmm. parts were there, all the workers, you know, doing paint, doing doors, doing engines. And they all worked at the same factory, and they were permanent employees, not all of them, mm-hmm. but a lot of them were permanent employees, and there was an expectation that you worked for life. Now, there are scholars recently who have shown persuasively that that was a lot more of a promise rather than the actual reality of auto worker experience, but it can't not be denied that the direction companies move in is more towards what I would call a networked or distributed capitalism. Mm-hmm. Again, that's big words. What does it mean? It means that you download as much as you can of possible. You don't make something. You don't do something that you can't just contract somebody else to do. Right? Walmart doesn't make anything. Walmart just has suppliers that control other suppliers, mm-hmm. and they just network that whole chain to make sure that the goods are in their stores at the lowest possible price, right? And car companies increasingly just subcontract out all of the work of production and then just are finance companies that kind of put cars together at the very last stage. And what this means for workers is they require greater flexibility of workers and less obligations.
Yeah, so we are the precariat.
Yes. So mm-hmm. you have increased precarity. And what I argue in the book is that you see this happening as a canary in the coal mine in the auto industry in the 1960s. And mm-hmm. what Chrysler does with response to this increasing competition is they start downloading more and more stress and more pressure onto on the employment hierarchy, who are the overwhelmingly African-American workers they hire, who have less status, less benefits, and they work them much harder. And the combination of racism, thus, and job intensification, I argue in the book, creates kind of a lot of individualized violence. And that's individualized violence because these workers are not cared about by the company, mm-hmm. and they're treated as disposable individuals. And they're also not there's no real home for them in the union. Because the union, at the same time, is also racist, is also hostile or unsympathetic to the specific plight of African American workers, and so workers themselves are caught in the middle, and they see nobody that really speaks for them, and so they're much more likely to kind of lash out individually with all the pressure that they are under, rather than see their plight as a part of a larger collective issue.
Did they form their own union, or did they form their own activist group?
Some black activists in the plant formed a group called Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, and this was a kind of black nationalist union that was as critical of the United Auto Workers for not representing them as they were of the auto factory.
And it was seen as more of a militant group too, from what it came across. Is that right?
Yeah. Absolutely. It was seen as very militant. It was seen as violent. And certainly they were very inflammatory in a lot of their rhetoric, and a lot of their pamphlets and newsletters often celebrated incidents of violence. But as I argue in the book, scholars and the mainstream have kind of, I think, essentialized or assumed that this group was violent, and that's what this group was about.
But you have to see where the violence is coming from in the first place.
Yeah, and that's what I was able to do in my research. Mm-hmm. I was able to point out that violence was on the rise in the plant well before Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, or DRUM as they were called, mm-hmm. rose in the plant. And you can see from their early statements that they are responding to violence in the mm-hmm. plant. And interestingly, when we talk about violence in the plant, one of the questions I always got when I was researching this project and writing it, I tell people I'm working on a book about workplace violence. One of the first questions I often got was, what do you define as violence? And that's a really good question because it's a tricky, slippery subject. And I would tell people that, you know, what I noticed in the research was that what counted as violence was itself a topic that people were struggling over.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to go in and kind of impose in 2019 or whatever, 2020, to go back and say, well, this is what the violence was and this is what it wasn't in these plants. Mm-hmm. Number one, I think that's arrogant of me, somebody who did not live through those plants, to say that. But number two, I think it was really important that there were people who said, well, what is violent is when these workers show up with guns. That's violence. And then those workers would say,
that's seen violence. But we've talked about, yes. We've had this conversation off record in terms of like violence that's seen and violence that's unseen. And I think that's where it's like, that's where Rob Nixon comes in so beautifully and talks about those acts of slow violence that are unseen, that lead them sometimes to that kind of physical scene violent episodes that we see with people who have their humanity has been erased bit by bit by bit, and there's nothing really left but to produce an act of violence to be seen or heard or
those individual mm-hmm. acts of violence often occur out of structural violence, out mm-hmm. of a larger structure of violence, and you know, I was able to trace how much of this individual violence rose in the Detroit factories, and I tell people often when I speak about this book, you look back and see all this violence happening in the late 60s, and if you're thinking about it, I mean, you're not going to say to yourself, well, I guess Chrysler hired, you know, 1,000 bad people in 1967 mm-hmm. and just looked for the, you know, meanest, most violent people they could bring into the factory. Clearly, there's something larger structural that's producing this,
mm-hmm.
right? And it was really interesting for me, like, you know, people like Rob Nixon, people like Zizek, who have written some really insightful stuff theoretically on violence, to see their arguments being made decades before them by people, you know, in the auto plants or people writing about these auto plants in the 60s and 70s saying, why is it violent when a worker hits another, you know, his boss with a crowbar, that ends up on the 6 o'clock news. But we have heart attacks in here all the time, or people losing
people
fingers.
Maimed. Not having safe working spaces.
Or even, as I noticed, just the incredibly high, anecdotally, incidences of alcoholism and substance use disorder happening in these plants.
Mm-hmm.
Because people deal with the stress, or they deal with, the shift work, what you need to be up and down by drinking incredible amount or doing tons of drugs. And that's also a slow violence.
What's interesting about this to me is also, when did the shift work actually start in the auto industry? When did it become 24/7? Because that's an interesting shift for me, whether there was like a correlation between having a 24/7 system happening and increase in violence, because it's actually now physiologically it's altering you. There's a biological, physiological alteration that's happening within, leading to aggression, leading to violence, and a deregulated state.
That's a good question. And it's not something I looked at in my research process, but I would guess the good place to look would be with the introduction of the assembly line by Ford in the 1920s. Because when you have that much investment in, you know, what Marx would call fixed capital, or what we would just call, you know, equipment, machinery, as anyone who's in business or factory knows, when that machinery sits idle, it's not making you any money. All it's doing is slowly depreciating. So once you invest in your factory to put machines in, there is, as he illustrated in his book when he talks about work hours in Victorian England, there is a huge pressure to keep those going 24 hours a day, so you're getting the most out of your fixed capital.
But at the same time, he introduces the 40-hour work week, because he noticed that after about 8 hours, there was a cognitive decline and workers were making more and more errors, which was impacting the bottom line.
But that certainly can be an 8-hour day in terms of an early shift, an afternoon shift, and a night shift, which I know that they were certainly doing.
Yeah, because prior to that, it was, I think it was 14 to 16 hours.
Yes.
Or even 20 hours.
Yeah.
Work days. This is pre-union, is it the Wagner Act?
The Wagner Act is one of the ones that made collective bargaining a lot more feasible in the United States. I've work time has always been like a really fascinating issue for me. And
me too.
I'm sure everybody who tunes into the podcast. And one of the things I think about, we think back to, you know, scholars have looked at these 12-hour, 16-hour work days, and granted, a lot of them were objectively more hostile to one's well-being and more draining than an 8-hour day.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also scholars say, if you look at some of those 12 to 16-hour work days, there's also so many more breaks worked in. There's so much more of worker control of the pace in some of these places. It depends on where we're talking about working.
Yeah, and also I think before that there was also a little bit more autonomy, just post-Wagner Act and pre-post-Ford movement, I suppose, between the 40s and the 50s. 40s, 50s, I think, would be a good place would be a good time to be in an auto industry in the 1940s and 1950s?
I would say, you know, in some senses, it's interesting, because I think that we really romanticize that era of work. Mm-hmm. We really do. And there's very good reasons which we do so, in terms of the belief of the people should have stability, that working class people should have a good wage and benefits and access to leisure. Like, all those things are great. But, you know, one of the most recent reviews of my book on the Lawyers, Guns, and Money blog, the guy points out, like, he's like, what I really liked about this book is this book points out that a lot of these jobs are really terrible.
Yeah.
And if we should romanticize them, then we also we should be aware that we're romanticizing work that killed people regularly. And that was enormously, even in the 50s, enormously, you know, draining and fatiguing and dangerous and dirty.
So you're saying there was never a good time to be in the auto industry?
Depends on what you're interested in. The auto industry has always been hard. It's always been hard work. And quite often, too, that book I referred to earlier called Disrupting Detroit, even in the so-called 50s and 60s, he points out most auto workers were out of work a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And we think of it as, oh, you got in at GM and you got your 8 hours and you got 25 years and then you were out and you had this total ironclad stability. His book points out that in Detroit, that was not true for a lot of auto workers because of, I talk about it in my book a bit too, model changeovers, when you're instead of making the 59 Eldorado, now you're making the 60 Eldorado, and the machinery has to get changed and everybody gets laid off. Or if in this very hierarchical economy, there's a steel strike in another industry, you can't get parts, you're laid off for 6 months. So a lot of workers had to actually deal with a lot of instability. And what workers does that affect the most? Well, usually it's workers of color and female workers who have the least stability or seniority in that workplace. So,
and why then the misperception? Why do we have this?
Because inequality was lower and the standard of living for working class people was objectively higher than I would argue it is now.
But not all people.
No.
As we want to be, we want to be very clear about that too.
Absolutely.
That it's not, it wasn't for women, it wasn't for people of color.
Yes.
Yeah, it was strictly for white.
Not strictly, but generally. Absolutely, yeah. I think people look back on a time when it seemed like, first of all, standards of living were rising in those years.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easy to look back as it was good times because things were objectively getting materially better for working class people. So that's number one. People's ability to consume greatly expanded in the 1950s and 60s. Some of the social welfare programs that we most look back on now. Workers objectively had, working class people had objectively more power in the economy. If you think of, what one could do with a high school education then in the mm-hmm. 1960s versus what you can do with a bachelor's degree now, not very comparable. Union density, far higher, which meant that workers had more power. So there are things that people look back on that were objectively better for working people.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, history is complex and there was a lot of things that weren't so much. And in the Windsor plants that I study, they had less violence than the Detroit plants because the union was more stable because of the auto pact. They didn't have to worry about the jobs going away. It was a more stable factory, but it was still a very white factory
mm-hmm.
where racialized workers had a very hard time. Women workers in the Windsor factories weren't even hired until the mid-70s, until the government basically made them.
Yeah, that was very interesting. And then it was also problematic because they were harassed.
Yeah, and intimidated.
Yeah,
I talked to one of the pioneering female workers there who later became high up in the auto workers union. And she talks about getting followed, being out front of her, sitting on her porch having a beer after work and a guy driving by in a car really slowly right in front mm-hmm. of her house until she basically went and talked to some of her brothers in the union and it stopped. And I said, well, how did that happen? Did they, was there violence involved? Did they mm-hmm. find the guy and beat him up, basically? And she's like, well, definitely could have been. Because even in that very stable working class culture,
mm-hmm.
there was a lot of violence.
Yeah.
There were fights between supervisors and employees. There was fights between employees. There was bullying and hazing on the job.
Yeah.
There was, as we talked about, the harassment and intimidation of female workers.
Continued to this day. I mean, we're still figuring this out to this day.
Right? And so I guess one of the contributions my book tried to make was this wider picture of violence, and that we really kind of think of workplace violence as, one person goes in with a gun. But really, violence flows in a lot of different directions in the workplace, and it takes a lot of different forms. And people do it to protest their treatment
mm-hmm.
And change the workplace. And some people do violence to keep the workplace the same, to let people, quote unquote, know their place or how we do things and to stop that from changing. So violence, unfortunately, this is the classic historian's answer, is an extremely complex phenomenon that works in a lot of different ways and flows in a lot of different directions in these workplaces.
Yeah, and it's not always physical and it's not always seen. And that's really, really important thing, actually,
mm-hmm.
to come out of this book for me. Was that idea of that how it can be so unseen, and then once it becomes apparent, we forget the factors that led to, or not forget, or not acknowledge,
no,
or not understand.
I think
Do you think we're forgetting? We're forgetting.
I'm not forgetting. I spent 8 years of my life thinking about this. So, but I think it's. I don't understand how it is. That it's like this thunderbolt mentality, that when there is this shocking incident of violence, people focus on the incident and don't think of you know, all of the factors in the workplace that led up to it.
Because it's complex, and it requires thought process, and it requires actual participation in the conversation. And I think we do have short attention spans in that way, and we already have so much and perhaps all kinds of violence going on within us that that's not something we want to be paying attention to until it comes to us in a way. Then we start paying attention to it. And also it's happening almost everywhere all the time. Maybe it's in our face. Maybe it's in our face all the time in so many different ways, whether it's war in Syria or somebody taking a gum to students somewhere. And
yeah, it definitely is. And also, I mean, in terms of doing something about something, it's a lot easier and more straightforward in a lot of ways to put one person in jail than it is to try to make larger changes that will prevent somebody from shooting somebody the next time.
Mm-hmm.
That's hard. I mean, it's easy to, after the fact, say, well, this person, you know.
Yeah, give the blame and then and the responsibility of the action to a singular person or an entity rather than changing the system, which requires changing both political and social and economic systems.
But it also, writing this book and researching it really brought home to me how much, like, what is the acceptable level of violence in our society?
What is it?
It's very high, I think. I think it's much higher than I would like it to be. And because I was thinking about these workplaces, like, and everybody who's read this book and talked to me about it has been like, I can't, like, it's, he's like, they're like, these workplaces, it's unbelievable. Like, there's so much violence in the 1970s. Like, you know, because the book itself, it's very, you know, gruesome in some parts. There's talk.
It actually really is. And I didn't want to bring that up. But yeah, it actually is. It's very, these are very harsh realities that you talk about.
Yeah.
I think, and that's one of the things I really, really liked about it, is that how you dug up these stories of these people and you brought them on and you discussed it in its raw details. And for me, that was fantastic. I really appreciated actually reading that. Like, you're combining history, but you're also combining people's realities and their stories into it. And you're weaving it, explaining, not just from the perspective of a historian collecting this, but also from their own perspective. And I think you did an amazing job. I really appreciate this.
Well, thank
you. It's taken me to places, Jeremy, that I am still exploring. It's amazing. I hope you're going to come back because I want to have a conversation of post-neoliberalism with
you. Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I mentioned before we got started is that I'm currently researching a book on the relationship between addiction, recovery, and the workplace.
Yes.
And we often think of it as addiction is all about the state and the prison system or the healthcare system, but we don't think about so much for people. Addictions are diagnosed or in the workplace. They're treated through workplace health and so much.
And that they start at a very, very young age.
Yeah. And also that a lot of what we think of as addiction or substance use disorder occurs because of the demands of people's work, which I'm sure you see in your research all the time.
All the time, especially with adolescence research. That's something that interests me to no end in terms of when it starts in the adolescent's brain, when the addiction actually starts. And that's something also that I'm really actually interested in and exploring right now, because that's when the mental disorders start to occur during adolescence. And then once it becomes kind of this behavior, it's very difficult to change because it becomes kind of a permanent part of your system, and you will return to that over and over again if it's not regulated early on.
Yeah, and especially I think in my own research in a workplace in a society that I'm arguing in this book kind of reinforces and encourages addictive type adaptations and behaviors rather than encourages, you know, things that are healthier for
us. Because mental health is still such a taboo in our society. It's not something we talk about openly, as I said, you know. When we throw words around well-being, just like candy, well-being, go out for a walk, you'll feel better. Take a yoga class, you'll feel better. Meditate, take those deep breaths in and it'll, you know, take you to a better place.
Then you can go back to work.
Then you can go back to work and then be a productive like it all comes down to, I think, is productivity.
And I think that builds on what we were talking about before, how it's easier to decry individual acts of violence and say, well, we want nonviolent workplaces. Mm-hmm. And I argue in the end of the book, a lot of, you know, there's policies about workplace violence. And in some senses, those are a big step forward. I think there have been major step forwards in harassment and violence against women in the workplace, although mm-hmm. there's still so much more that needs to be done there. But what hasn't happened is in so many cases is there's a policy or there's language about violence at work, but there isn't a sense of like, well, how do we actually change the way workplace is set up to make it less violent? Just like with mental health, mm-hmm. there's a lot of talk about, well, let's talk and let's have awareness. But there's not a sense of, well, what is it in society that's producing so much trauma and so much mental illness?
Neoliberalism.
Spoilers, yeah. I'd love to come back and thank you very much for having this conversation with me.
Oh, thank you so much for having this conversation with me. I say this, but I'm so delighted. I'm so delighted you're here. I'm so glad we're having this conversation. And I think conversations are important. I think that's where we start, because I think that's what leads to a shift in consciousness when we start talking about it. And I really appreciate your book. As I said, I cannot, every time I read it, it takes me onto a different journey. And I am, I'm so looking forward to our next conversation, Jeremy. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Ruhi Sleep, Sleep and Society podcast, available on ruhisleep.ca. Don't forget to follow us on social media @ruhisleep on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Thank you for listening.